Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Anna Mateo and Steve Ember. But first, this report. For some people, higher education is not just a goal in life, but also an expectation. In the United States, if your parents attended a college or university, there is a good chance that you will too. Even if your parents did not go to college, you still have a good chance of completing higher education if your family is wealthy. But your chances are reduced if you come from a needy family, a community with limited educational resources, or you simply have no one to follow as an example. Helping those in need is one of the main ideas behind a strategy of behavioral science called nudge theory or nudging. Nudging is a way of changing people's behavior through indirect suggestion and by supporting positive actions. It was popularized in the 2008 book Nudge. The book was a project of a legal expert and an economist with the University of Chicago. A growing number of U.S. colleges and universities look to nudging as a way to support poor, minority, and first-generation students. They also are using it to increase overall graduation rates. Two common forms of nudging are emails to students and text messages to their mobile phones. Schools and other educational organizations keep in contact with students this way, offering advice and help when needed. However, recent studies have shown that there is more than one way nudging can go wrong. And making use of nudging to influence large groups of students is harder than it seems.
Alejandra Acosta is a higher education policy expert at New America, an independent research group. She notes that there are several qualities a nudge campaign must possess in order to be successful. Acosta says messages must be timely, meaning they reach college students well before the date by which a student is required to take action. Additionally, nudges should be written clearly and provide as much information as possible. If students start to struggle in class, school officials should not just message them, saying they should seek academic support. The message should give information about what kinds of support the college or university offers and exactly how the student can make use of them. That is why nudges should possess interactive qualities, Acosta says. For example, students should be able to ask questions of school officials or be directed to a website for more information. In addition, colleges and universities must ensure their support services are in place and working as best they can. You can't expect to just send a nudge in a text or an email and be like, "Okay, we're done," Acosta told VOA. To change behavior, there has to be other supporting structures there, too. When nudges work, they can do a lot of good. In 2017, a nonprofit group and an education services company launched a nudging campaign at 4 U.S. community colleges. They worked with nearly 10,000 first-year students at 3 such colleges in Ohio and one in Virginia. A recent study found that older and minority students who agreed to receive these nudges were 16 to 20% more likely to continue into their second year than those who did not.
Iris Palmer is a senior advisor for higher education and the workforce at New America. She warns that even if nudges are clear, informative, and timely, they can actually create problems, especially for the student who needs them the most. Palmer told VOA, "An example of this would be, I'm a student who has never been to college before. My family has never been to college before. I come to college and I wonder if I'm college material. I get a message that says, you're getting a failing grade in this class. You need to come talk to your advisor. And I think, oh, I'm failing. I wasn't even college material to begin with. I should just leave now." Nudges need to be personal or appear to be written for the individual student, not as a general communication to a large group, she noted. This means they need to be structured carefully, requiring schools and educational organizations to know something about the individuals they are nudging. Palmer argues school officials should research what their students' needs are and shape nudges to be related to those needs. Officials also must not make it seem like students have no other choice but to take a given action. But Kelly Rosinger points out that while nudging is successful in a lot of ways, it has yet to show signs of success when dealing with very large groups. Rosinger serves as an assistant professor in the Department of Education Policy Studies at Penn State University.
Rosinger admits that nudging can be a low-cost, useful way of getting students to meet relatively simple goals on time. This includes completing the U.S. government documents necessary for financial aid. However, last month, Rosinger and other researchers reported on a study in which they looked at two nudging experiments. The National Bureau of Economic Research published their findings. The experiments nudged over 800,000 students through physical mail, emails, and text messages. The study found that these efforts had almost no effect on the number of students starting college, using financial aid, or continuing from one year to the next. Rosinger says the reason the experiments failed was because the nudges were trying to reach so many students. This made the messages seem more general and, as a result, less effective. She suggests that for now, nudging works best when it comes from local groups working with smaller numbers of students in their community. Just getting a message from an organization you are familiar with can create more of that personalization, she said. It may make the message more salient to students when they're getting it. I'm Dorothy Gundy.
And I'm Pete Musto.
Now, the VOA Learning English program, Words and Their Stories. On this show, we explain where words and expressions in the English language come from, and probably more important for those learning to speak English, how we use them. Our show today starts off with a bang. Yes, that was the sound of an explosion. When I said the show will start with a bang, what I meant to say is that it will open with a lot of energy and excitement. That is how we use the phrase with a bang. But since we are here, let's talk about the words explode explosion, and explosive. You probably know all three words. An explosion is often loud and dangerous, and it can cause much damage. But you might not know that English speakers often use the word explosive to describe other things. Events or issues that are explosive are likely to happen suddenly and violently. And explosive people can be suddenly violent. There are a few words we often use with explosive. These word pairings are good to know for two main reasons. One, they are go-to terms that make word choice easier. And two, your spoken English will sound more natural, more like a native speaker. It is important to note that not all explosive pairings are bad. An explosive laugh, for example, is not violent. It is simply laughter that happens suddenly and loudly. And if a company experiences explosive growth, the business grows greater than expected and in a shorter amount of time. But generally speaking, we use explosive word pairings when talking about bad things. A few examples are explosive issue, explosive force, explosive temper, and explosive personality. Let's talk more about that last one. Someone with an explosive personality blows up at the smallest thing, and this can cause problems. Explosive people are quick to have a hostile or even violent reaction to something. You could say they have a short fuse. Many explosives, especially older ones, usually have a fuse. You light the fuse to set off the explosion. So someone with a short fuse explodes at even small things. They are volatile. This is the opposite of a long fuse, which takes longer to set off an explosion. People have time to run away and take cover. But a short fuse can be dangerous. People don't have time to escape. So people with short fuses can be dangerous to be around. You never know when they will blow up. We often use the term blow up to mean lose your temper. Another expression with a similar meaning is time bomb. Sometimes we say someone is a ticking time bomb. This means we are not sure when this person is going to get angry, but we are sure that he or she will. Another term that describes a dangerous or unpredictable situation is powder keg. Many years ago, a powder keg was a small container used to hold gunpowder. These days, a powder keg is something that is likely to explode. We usually use this term to describe a situation that is ready to blow up. I hope you enjoyed this program on explosive terms. Use them the next time you need to describe something exciting or violent. And that's Words and Their Stories for this week. Until next time, I'm Anna Mateo.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in Special English. I'm Steve Ember. This week in our series, we continue the story of America's second president, John Adams. He took office in 1797. He had served 8 years as vice president under President George Washington. Now, state electors had chosen him to govern the new nation. Adams was an intelligent man. He was a patriot and an able diplomat. But he did not like party politics. This dislike caused trouble during his presidency because two political parties struggled for power during his time in office. Adams was caught in the middle. John Adams was a member of the Federalist Party. As president, he should have been party leader. But this position belonged to a man who really knew how to get and use political power, Alexander Hamilton. Hamilton had served as Treasury Secretary under President Washington. Now, Hamilton was a private citizen, a lawyer in New York City. But he continued to have great influence over the national government. Federalists loyal to Hamilton controlled the Congress. Even President Adams' top cabinet secretaries were loyal to Hamilton. In fact, they worked together against the new president. This political situation made Adams' term in office very difficult. It also led to the end of Federalist Party power. John Furling is a professor emeritus of history at the University of West Georgia. He says every 50 years or so, the country experiences a period of extreme partisanship. He says the late 1700s were such a time. That partisanship helped split the Federalist Party.
They never were a viable party again after the election of 1800.
Two major issues marked Adams' presidency. One concerned foreign policy. The other concerned the rights of citizens. The first involved America's relations with France. Americans were divided on whether to support the revolution in France. At first, many saw it as similar to the American Revolution against Britain. Vice President Thomas Jefferson especially supported the French. France helped America win its war for independence from Britain. The country's friendship continued when Thomas Jefferson served as minister to Paris. But many Federalists came to strongly oppose the revolution in France. They were horrified by the execution of the French king and queen. They did not like the idea of common people taking power. Federalists wanted an alliance with Britain. Over time, they demanded war with France. They used their power to prevent the American government from sending a pro-French representative to Paris. They also searched for any signs of insult, any excuse to declare war. John Furling says President Adams did not agree with the majority of Federalists.
Adams, from the very beginning, seeks and what he called an honorable peace. He tried to look for some sort of central position, centrist position, between the radical conservatives on the right and the radical liberals on the left.
Adams was afraid that the French Revolution would destroy America. He believed the American economy and government would collapse if the country became involved in Europe's struggle. So Adams tried to improve relations with France through negotiations. At the same time, Adams strengthened America's defenses. "We will be ready," he said, "if war comes." One incident especially brought France and America close to war. It is known in American history books as the X, Y, and Z affair. President Adams had appointed a committee of ministers to negotiate with the French government. French officials kept the ministers waiting for several weeks. While they waited, the ministers had a visit from three Frenchmen, later called X, Y, and Z. X, Y, and Z told the American ministers that France would sign an agreement if the United States did three things. It had to lend the French government $12 million. It had to apologize for anti-French statements in a recent message from President Adams to the American Congress. And it had to pay the French foreign minister $250,000. The American ministers were willing to pay, but they wanted to sign the agreement first. The French foreign minister refused. First the money, then the agreement. The Federalists finally had the excuse they were looking for. France had insulted the United States. The only answer was war, they said. Federalist newspapers added fuel to the fire by publishing anti-French propaganda. In a few places, pro-war groups became violent. The Republican Party could do little. Even Thomas Jefferson was helpless. He remained in Philadelphia, the capital of the United States at that time, but he had few friends there anymore. Congress quickly passed laws to create a permanent army and navy. It also approved new taxes to pay for them. And it passed two new laws by a narrow majority. These laws greatly increased the powers of the national government. They were known as the Alien and Sedition Acts. Federalists said the laws were necessary to protect national security. But in effect, the Federalists used them to weaken the power of the Republican Party. Under the Alien Act, the president could accuse any foreigner living in the United States of being a threat to national security. He could order that person out of the country. The act also increased the time a foreigner had to wait to become a citizen from 5 years to 14 years. Republicans were furious. Most foreigners, when they became naturalized citizens, joined the Republican Party. Republicans argued that the Alien Act violated the Constitution. They said it gave the government more powers than were stated in the Constitution. Federalists said the act was constitutional. They said the Constitution gave the government the right to defend the country against foreign aggression. The other law, the Sedition Act, barred the publication of anything that might incite public hostility against the government. Republicans argued that this act violated Americans' constitutional rights of free speech and a free press. Federalists once again defended it as necessary for national security. The Federalists tried to use the Sedition Act to quiet Republican critics of President Adams' administration. About 25 people were charged under the Sedition Act. These included several leading Republican newspapermen and a Republican member of Congress. Some of the men were tried, found guilty, and sent to prison. But other Republicans took their places in the fight against the act. The Federalists' plan to stop criticism did not succeed. President Adams had signed the Alien and Sedition Acts into law. He believed they were necessary to protect the United States at a time when war with France was still possible. And his wife Abigail believed that passing the laws would stop newspapers from criticizing him.
The one piece of advice that she offers that is unfortunate and in fact catastrophic is that she really urges him to pass the Alien and Sedition Acts, which becomes the biggest blunder of his presidency.
Joseph Ellis is a history professor at Mount Holyoke College and the author of a book about John and Abigail Adams. He says Adams regretted passing the laws. In early 1799, Adams received several reports that France was ready to reopen negotiations on improving relations. He immediately nominated a new minister to France. Federalist senators threatened to reject the nomination. In the end, Adams agreed to nominate a committee of three ministers. The Senate approved them. It was many months before the three men went to France to negotiate the agreement, and it was many more months before they completed their work. But they did so on September 30th, 1800. After several years of bitter political struggle at home, President Adams finally prevented war with France. Later, he wrote that there was one thing he would like to be remembered for more than anything else. He gave himself the task of making peace with France, and he succeeded.
We can't say that about every American president, but we can say it about John Adams.
Historian John Ferling says he believes the United States would not have survived if the Americans had gone to war with France. Historian Joseph Ellis agrees.
I think that the long-term achievement of the Adams presidency is to preserve the coherence of a stable government and to see that the revolution survives and consolidates its energies and continues on into the 19th century.
1800 was another presidential election year in the United States. The Federalist Party appeared to be dying. The Republican Party had more popular support. It also had gained an increasing number of seats in state legislatures and in Congress. Party leader Thomas Jefferson was sure to be elected president, unless the Federalists could find a way to change the electoral process.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.